year with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two friends who served in the Vietnam War together.
James Blankenheim and Everett Wood are friends with a shared experience of military service during the Vietnam War. They speak of the excitement of forging one's path in life, the realities of combat, and the struggles of integration after returning home. Blankenheim and Wood shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative. As a warning, parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Jim Blankenheim, 71 years old, and I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. And my partner here is a corpsman that was with me in Vietnam.
My name's Everett T. Wood, and my age is 73. And I'm in Vincennes, Indiana. The relationship to Jim is, he was a forward observer with us and called in artillery, airstrikes, and tried to help us out during the bad times when we needed help. So how did you get involved? Did you get drafted?
No, I enlisted. My father, when I turned 18, made the comment that he thought I'd never amount to shit. And I said, I'll show you. And not only would I join the military, but I would join the toughest branch they had. That's how I got in the Marine Corps. And also, I felt I needed to do my duty anyway. It's run through our family. So how about you, Doc?
Well, I got off high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. My parents didn't have very much money. You know, I didn't want them to help me through school. You know, I just wanted to be on my own and try to find my own direction, I guess. So I joined the Navy. So remember Hill 1192?
Oh, yeah. That was probably the bloodiest battle we saw.
That was the worst I've ever gone through.
There was like 80 of us walked up in the mountains on what they said was going to be a three-day patrol. What was it, 15 days later we got out of there?
15 guys died up on that hill.
That we had no place to put the bodies or the wounded, so they all laid right in the middle of our mini perimeter. And Milligan was there. He got shot in the chest and shot in the leg.
Right. I patched him up.
He lasted 4 days before we could medevac him out. And when he went out, I thought he was dead. I thought he'd never make it. We went to that reunion in Ohio, and he showed up there, and I went, you got to be kidding me. You're alive?
I know.
Because I didn't think he made it.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, once they left, we put them on a helicopter.
Yeah, it's the last you heard.
I mean, you don't know if they're alive or dead. They never hear from them. So it's tough.
Did you write home?
I wrote home when I could, you know.
I could not tell my mother what was going on over there because it would have killed her.
Yeah, I know.
I just said, you know, like, you know what it was for us for a typical day? That's all I called it. You remember when we came home? The welcome home we got?
I don't know. I mean, I had problems adjusting when I came back.
Yeah, so did I.
I kissed the ground when I got home, when I got in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I come home, and I walk in the door, and my dad was totally unaware that I was even coming home. And I walked in, and he gave me this big hug. And in my entire life, he never hugged me like that. And I said, you know, for every rotten thing you ever did to me, you paid for it that day.
I mean, I was really happy to be back after seeing all the stuff we went through. I'm glad we made it through that experience together.
Yeah.
And after all these years, meeting each other again.
That was James Blankenheim of Madison, Wisconsin, and Everett Wood of Vincennes, Indiana. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, reimagining Lowhead dams and converting them into whitewater parks and fish passageways. This conversation, it comes to us from a listener suggestion. Dwayne emailed to say he wanted to learn more about Iowa's efforts to remove dangerous dams. Our team did some digging, and sure enough, over the past decade, Iowa has become a national leader in its water trails and Lowhead Dam public hazard program. What questions do you have about turning dams into whitewater parks? How would you feel about removing a dam in your community? 800-642-1234 to join in. And Dwayne, thanks for the tip. Nate Hogevein is Director of River Programs for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Nate, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Good morning. The DNR says these Lowhead dams are really dangerous. Give us a picture in our mind's eye what these dams look like.
They're basically a wall across a river that backs the river up, usually just a little bit. It might only be a couple feet high. Sometimes they're up to, 10 or 12 feet high. And the water, isn't controlled or anything like when you think of a big flowage type dam in northern Wisconsin. It's more of a, just constantly falling over this wall.
A deep, drop.
And what happens is the water drops straight down in a very uniform way, and then it launches back up and creates something called a hydraulic or a boil line. And from there, water is going downstream, but it's also flowing back upstream toward the dam because it's a high spot on the water. And so what happens is people sometimes get stuck in these. And in Iowa, at least, we see 1 to 2 fatalities per year on average. Sometimes we don't see any, sometimes we see more than that, but on average, that's about what we see. And so back in 2008, our legislature, after there was a rash of drownings at these dams, created the Lowhead Dam Public Hazard Program to address these dangers. And they mandated us to start spending some funds and working with communities around the state to address that hazard, and at the same time incorporate fish passage into any project that we were involved in.
And then lo and behold, whitewater parks come out of this brainstorm, if you will.
Right. certain communities have opted to do whitewater parks. And I should say that, that's not our primary goal exactly, other than that, when we go into a community and talk to them about what they might do with their dam, it's on the list of things that they're welcome to look at. And we've taken an approach saying that, we can do anything from a removal to more of a utilitarian type of rapids, if there's a infrastructure reason that the dam is there, or these kind of more economic development driven projects, whitewater courses, are on the table. It's just that they require a lot more local funding and a lot more local interest and effort because they're more expensive than other approaches.
How much more expensive are we talking about? What is the cost of one of these?
So the most recent one that was completed in Ames was about an $880,000 project. I just got all of their grant information back, and that would be one of the lower cost ones. We have 4 of these facilities in Iowa at this point. The most expensive one was about $2.5 million. That was in Manchester, Iowa, on the Maquoketa River. And there's one being planned currently in Des Moines right now at the Scott Avenue Dam, which is, it's on a very large river, and it's in the middle of the city. And the dam is integrated into a bridge, and it's a very expensive project. That one will be, at this point, I can say tens of millions of dollars. when the final design comes out, we'll know exactly how much that is. But so, that one's partly being federally funded as well.
How common are these low head dams used for rivers in Midwestern states like your own, like Iowa?
Oh, they're extremely common. And a lot of these were originally mill sites, and they weren't necessarily like a concrete dam across a river. They might have been a pile of rocks that, you know, backed up some water that was used to drive a water wheel at one point. But, you know, a lot of them were converted to like small hydropower dams that later, you know, became economically inefficient as other ways of generating power developed. Some of them are created in the Great Depression, actually, as basically projects to keep people working.
Public works,
Public works projects, yeah. And so a few of them are created more for water supply. In a lot of those cases, we would advise the community to, you know, replace the low head dam with a rapids type of structure. You know, because they still have some purpose. They're around for a lot of reasons, and they're, frankly, a lot of them have outlived their original purpose, at least. We see a lot of deterioration because a lot of these are pushing 100 years old or more. So a lot of times the communities we're working with are at a decision point. You know, it's like we're either going to have a failure or we need to do something. And nobody, at least in Iowa, is really paying or helping people financially to refurbish a dam as a low head dam. So that helps us get a foot in the door with these communities.
Yeah, look at next steps or, you know, where you go from here. We're talking with Iowa DNR River Programs Director Nate Hogevane, who is explaining his state's efforts over the years to remove or modify these low head dams and perhaps to make way for more recreational uses and to mitigate the hazards that dams present. Have you visited one of Iowa's whitewater parks? What do you remember about the experience? How concerned are you about the safety of dams? Does the dam in your community have adequate fencing or signage? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nate Hogevane here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about turning dangerous dams into river recreation and the Iowa model. The first Iowa whitewater park was built in Charles City in 2010, closer to the Wisconsin border. Elkader boasts a single wave that is 22 feet wide. It's called the Gobbler. And here in Wisconsin near Madison, the city of Stoughton is working on plans for a whitewater park along the Yahara River. Would you go this route to remove a dam from your community? How do you feel about the viability of these whitewater park projects? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We have River Programs Director at the Iowa DNR, Nate Hogevane, who's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call on this, Nate. Tom is joining us from Burlington with a question. Hi, Tom, go ahead.
Here in Burlington, we have a dam that is dammed up Echo Park, and the park is only about 6 inches of water in there, so they have to do something about it, but they're afraid to do something because every time they try to drain it, there's so much cow manure, it smells, and the neighbors don't want them to drain it. But my question is this. Out west, we have these aquifers that are sucking up all the water. They're dropping it at an incredible weight, like some rate, like 40 feet a year or something, brother. And I just wonder, is there any way we can tie this in the rivers that we have on top of the land to get the water down into replacing these aquifers?
All right, Tom, thank you. So, Tom, concerned about aquifers drying up, can there be any solution with these rivers and, you know, perhaps the dams?
So western water issues and eastern water issues, and I'd say, you know, Iowa's kind of the last eastern state. I'd draw that line at about the Missouri River. Those issues are really different, you know, and the biggest difference is rainfall. So like in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, we're getting from, you know, 20 to almost 30 inches a year. And out west, you might have like 12 or 15. I think in the Midwest, I had mentioned water supply earlier as a purpose of some of the dams. And sure, yeah, they can help create a shallow aquifer in some cases. And like I said, we are able to, you know, really accomplish the same purpose by building, say, a rock arch rapids with boulders and smaller stone. But that's really just for collecting water, you know, out in kind of a sand lens near the river. Mm-hmm. In terms of like our like deep aquifers, which I think he was referring to, those are recharged over a very long period of time. But we don't have those disappearing aquifers in the Midwest like they do out west.
Tom, thanks for the call. John is joining us now from Menominee. Hi, John. Go ahead. I understand you've paddled some of these whitewater parks before.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a kind of a novice whitewater paddler. I enjoy getting out there and recreating with friends and people I'd like to hang out with. And, you know, Wausau has got probably our premier whitewater park in Wisconsin, and some might argue in the Midwest, and I've paddled that many times. And, you know, we'll travel around northern Wisconsin to find whitewater, the Red River, the Peshtigo, the, you know, the Wolf, and go up to the Brule. And we have some whitewater over here in west central Wisconsin at Jim Falls on the Chippewa River, which is part of the dam release from the Chippewa. And I just, you know, I think that these parks provide a great opportunity for people who have interest in paddling. It brings people will travel to come and paddle in those parks. And they, it brings up opportunities for local training and local groups and clubs to kind of congregate around these features. And I just think it would be a really great thing for any community to take that dam and transition it into a whitewater park if it's at all feasible to do that with your elevations.
John, thank you so much. So John really getting out there on these paddling trips and really bringing in that tourism piece and that community interaction, Nate.
Yeah, John, and thanks for bringing up some great rivers that bring up some great memories. I cut my teeth on whitewater in Wisconsin rivers, I actually first learned to do it from the Hoofers at UW-Madison. So, it really, what you're saying has bared out for communities in Iowa. And I can give you an example at Manchester, Iowa. There's a whitewater course with six separate drops that was created in 2012. And we actually did a study of how many people we would see on random days throughout the summer season, just in the area around the dam. We did that for 3 years leading up to the project being completed, and then did it for three more years after the project was completed. And, you know, this is just people recreating either on the water, fishing, walking along the river. We saw a 462 times increase in the amount of time people were spending along the river.
Wow.
You also started to see other things like, you know, a lot of downtowns in Iowa, at least, have kind of turned their backs on the river. You know, like their main street might be like a block off a river, and you know, just all the backs of the buildings that are facing the river. In Manchester, what's happened is people started building back decks on restaurants and bars, and a brewery opened up. It's just much more lively now. It's a kind of park setting with some retail mixed in.
So you saw that economic investment return there. Let's bring in Mark now in Green Bay. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, I didn't get the beginning of the show, but I was wondering if you, when you replace these dams with these rapids, does it allow fish to move through the river system that weren't allowed to before?
Yeah, that's correct. We require in these projects that the there's like a lower slope area next to the whitewater drop. So the whitewater drop is steeper and creates a wave, and it's actually not that great for fish passage. It's better than the dam, but you know, not that great. So we'll have a lower slope area with kind of more rocks protruding out and stuff where fish can burst up. And we've done a number of studies on that too to verify that the fish passage is actually happening at these facilities. We also make it so that those the fish passage part is favored when the water gets really low, like when you get into a drought condition kind of thing. Mm. So we're pretty careful to make sure that that is incorporated. We're very serious about that because it has a huge effect on the river upstream, both for fish, but also, you know, mussels, you know, like little clams. Their young actually hitch a ride on fish's gills in order to recolonize stretches of river. And they're really important for water quality as well. And I think we're all for that.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for that question. Nate, you know, as we start to wrap up here in the last few seconds, do you have any tips for communities that might want to go this direction and convert that low head dam into a whitewater park?
Sure. And I think the biggest one is, you need to start by, you know, putting out some ideas, you know, and doing some education. But the critical thing is that everybody gets listened to right up front, you know, and that it becomes a whole community project, as opposed to, you know, maybe you've got one city council person and a business person with this big idea, and they're going to put it on the whole town. Yeah. I've seen that over and over again where that just doesn't work. You need to have those town hall meetings and have everybody who is interested in your river and that dam in particular needs a seat at the table. Yeah. And they need to be heard. When you start that way, it's just better.
Nate, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. I very much appreciate it.
Nate Hogevane is Director of River Programs for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.